on agriculture. Their claim was just laughable. Even more of the weed killer would likely be drenching U.S. farm fields had Monsanto succeeded with its plans to push an herbicide-tolerant trait into another key crop. Wheat, a staple in food products around the globe. Monsanto developed Roundup Ready wheat, in a type called hard red spring wheat, which is typically used to make bread flour, in the early 2000s, and sought mightily to bring it to market. But buyers in many foreign countries threatened to stop purchasing wheat from the United States if any biotech wheat was mixed into the market. In our opinion, it is unacceptable that a fine commodity is genetically modified just for the purpose of making it herbicide resistant. This does not offer a single advantage to the world, wrote Jeff Smits, a director of a large Belgium-based buyer of U.S. wheat that operated mills across Northern Europe, in a 2001 memo to American wheat industry leaders. Monsanto's marketing research is a joke. GMO wheat for sure will be a market destructor. American farmers who feared losing export markets also pushed back against Monsanto. The opposition became so fierce that in 2004, Monsanto ended efforts to commercialize the GMO wheat, though the company said in 2014 it still hoped to bring a GMO wheat to market someday. Even without the genetic modification, Monsanto still encouraged farmers to spray glyphosate directly on wheat and on a number of other crops that are not genetically altered. The trick, Monsanto told farmers, was to apply the herbicide just days before the crops were to be harvested. Marketing materials put out by the company guide farmers in pre-harvest treatments of the chemical on not only wheat, but also milling oats, barley, peas, lentils, dry beans, and other crops. The idea is both to limit the growth of weeds after the field is harvested and, in some cases, to dry out the crops so they mature more uniformly, which makes harvesting more efficient for farmers. Monsanto recommends that farmers use glyphosate in various ways in conjunction with the production of more than 100 food crops, according to the EPA. The result is that glyphosate frequently has been used in various stages in the production of everything from alfalfa to oranges, avocados to apples, grapes to grapefruits. Even U.S.-grown almonds, a common snack for health-conscious people, are treated annually on average with an estimated 2.1 million pounds of glyphosate. Likewise, producers of cherries use an estimated 200,000 pounds of the pesticide annually, according to the EPA's analysis. About 3.2 million pounds are used annually for production of oranges, 1.5 million pounds for grapes, 600,000 pounds for walnuts, 400,000 pounds for pecans, 200,000 pounds for lemons, 100,000 pounds for oats, and 80,000 pounds for avocados. Still, the largest quantities of glyphosate by far are used on corn and soybeans. The USDA calculated that on average between 2004 and 2013, about 101 million pounds of glyphosate was used each year on U.S. soybean fields alone. Corn crops were sprayed with about 63.5 million pounds. Both estimates were up from a prior analysis that ran through 2011, which pegged average annual soybean use at 86.4 million pounds and corn at 54.6 million pounds. It's not clear just how glyphosate residue remains in your salad, sandwich, or snack, largely because regulators have elected for years not to look for glyphosate residues when they do annual testing of pesticide residues in food. For Mark Nelson, who applies glyphosate routinely to his crops, questions about glyphosate's safety are worrisome, but he is not ready to accept the warnings about cancer. Still, he tries to take every precaution, riding in a tractor with a charcoal-filtered cab and donning safety gear to try to avoid contact with the chemical. "We're careful out here," he said. Standing in his cornfield on a hot August afternoon, Nelson said he knows the end is coming for glyphosate. Even putting aside the health concerns, Weed resistance alone has made this once beloved farm aid less and less effective as the years pass. The rewards will soon no longer be worth the risk. "It's just not working like it used to," Nelson said. "I think eventually it's going to go away." Chapter 4. Weed Killer for Breakfast. For many people, a toasted bagel topped with honey might sound like a healthy breakfast choice. Others might prefer a bowl of oatmeal, cornflakes, or a hot plate of scrambled eggs. Few would likely welcome a dose of weed killer that has been linked to cancer in their morning meal. Yet that is exactly what private laboratory tests in the United States started showing with alarming frequency in 2014. Residues of the world's most widely used herbicide were making their way into American meals. Testing since then, by both private and public researchers, has shown glyphosate residues not only in bagels, honey, and oatmeal, but also in a wide array of products that commonly line grocery store shelves, including flour, eggs, cookies, cereal and cereal bars, soy sauce, beer, and infant formula. Indeed, glyphosate residues are so pervasive that they've been found in human urine. Livestock are also consuming their residues in grains used to make their feed, including corn, soy, alfalfa, and wheat. Glyphosate residues have been detected in bread samples in the United Kingdom for years, as well as in shipments of wheat leaving the United States for overseas markets. Americans are consuming glyphosate in common foods on a daily basis, the Alliance for Natural Health said in its April 2016 report, which revealed glyphosate residues detected in eggs and coffee creamer, bagels, and oatmeal. In January 2015, an advocacy group called GMO Free USA said tests it ordered show that Kellogg's Fruit Loops cereal contained trace amounts of glyphosate. The group blamed Kellogg Company for feeding children unlabeled GMOs and toxic herbicides and called for a boycott of Kellogg. The group also said testing showed glyphosate in PepsiCo Inc.'s Frito-Lay Sun Chip snacks. The food manufacturers responded by echoing Monsanto's company's assurances, saying that pesticide residues in food are common and that any glyphosate residues are not at unsafe levels. Researchers from Abraxis LLC, a Pennsylvania-based scientific diagnostics company, worked with Boston University on their own testing and reported in 2014 that they found glyphosate residues in 41 of 69 honey samples and in 10 of 28 samples of soy sauce purchased from U.S. grocery store shelves. One lab, Microbe Inatech Laboratories, was used by several concerned companies and groups for early rounds of glyphosate testing, in part because it was founded by a former Monsanto microbiologist, Bruce Hemming, who had a stellar reputation. Microbe Inatech was small, but it had received government grants to conduct food microbiological research. Moreover, Hemming was a career scientist and entrepreneur, as well as a former church missionary with 28 grandchildren, and he had a deep passion for using his scientific skills to help people. Hemming started his lab in 1991, offering microbial and biochemical analyses to a range of companies that wanted tests run on their consumer and industrial products. He was surprised when the interest in glyphosate testing emerged in 2014 and was soon very surprised by the results found in his laboratory, which he operates a mere 4 miles from Monsanto's massive corporate headquarters in a St. Louis suburb. Hemming knew from his work at Monsanto that glyphosate was not supposed to accumulate in the human body, but his lab detected glyphosate in breast milk samples and a range of other substances submitted for analysis. The shock quickly wore off as Hemming's lab became one of only a few in the United States juggling an influx of testing requests from food companies, public and private researchers, and consumer organizations, all trying to determine how much, if any, glyphosate was present in food, water, and bodily fluids. Hemming's reputation and that of his lab came under sharp criticism, however, by Monsanto and others who said the methodology and results were seriously flawed. Hemming's lab was using a method known as an enzyme-linked immunosorbent assay, ELISA, which the lab said was validated. But critics claimed ELISA was too likely to produce false results to be considered definitive proof of anything. Rising demand for more and better testing prompted one coalition of scientists and activists working through what they call the Detox Project to start offering testing in early 2016 through a laboratory at the University of California, San Francisco, that is registered with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA. The program was designed for individuals curious to learn if glyphosate is present in their bodies through urine testing, but it quickly expanded to include food product testing using the more precise and well-regarded method known as liquid chromatography tandem mass spectrometry, LC-MS-MS. The Detox Project warns would-be testers that they may not like what they find. The group says this on its website. Glyphosate is present at all levels of the food chain, in water, plants, animals, and even in humans. Every single study that has measured human contamination with glyphosate has found it. Despite claims that glyphosate has been widely studied by regulatory agencies and industry, little is known about the health effects of glyphosate-based herbicides at levels found in food or water. In North Dakota, an agronomist at the state university, Joel Ransom, became so curious about glyphosate residue that in 2014 he ran his own tests on flower samples from the region. North Dakota grows much of America's hard red spring wheat, a type that is considered the aristocrat of wheat, and carries the highest protein content of all classes of American wheat. It is used to make some of the world's finest yeast breads, hard rolls, and bagels. But growing the wheat and bringing a healthy crop to harvest is not always easy in a state known for cold and damp conditions. To make harvesting the crop easier, many North Dakota farmers spray their wheat crops directly with glyphosate to help dry the plants a week or so before they roll out their combines. The practice is also common in Saskatchewan, across the border in Canada. So when Ransom ran his tests on flower samples from the area, including flower from Canada, he expected to find some samples with glyphosate. He certainly did not expect all of them to have glyphosate residues, but they did. Ransom reported his findings to the Wheat Quality Council in February 2015, telling the group he was surprised by the results because it was generally believed by agricultural experts that if farmers used glyphosate as instructed, the pesticide's residues should not persist in the grain, let alone in the flour made from it. Researchers from the U.S. Geological Survey, USGS, have also been on the hunt for glyphosate residues in recent years. As an agency of the U.S. Department of the Interior, the USGS's mission is to provide scientific information about the health of the nation's natural resources. Part of its recent work has been tracking glyphosate use in America and the spread of the pesticide through the nation's waterways, air, and soil. USGS scientists have found glyphosate in something called AMPA, short for aminomethylphosphonic acid, widely in the environment, including commonly in surface waters, and in more than 50% of soil and sediment samples and water samples from ditches, drains, large rivers, and streams. The scientists also found the pesticide and the related acid in roughly 30% of lakes, ponds, and wetland areas. Glyphosate is definitely out there. You see it all the time. Glyphosate and AMPA are pervasive in the environment, said William Bataglin, a USGS hydrologist and past president of the American Water Resources Association. Bataglin co-authored the 2014 study for the USGS that found glyphosate and AMPA so prominently around the United States. Measuring residues that include those from AMPA, which is created as glyphosate starts to break down, is critical because AMPA is not just a benign byproduct. It carries its own set of concerns, scientists believe. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, did at one time include AMPA residues in calculations when setting a safe residue level for glyphosate in food. But it has not done so in recent years, a decision that many scientists believe adds to the hidden danger associated with the pesticide. It's a shell game of sorts, according to biologist Michael Hansen, who is a senior scientist with Consumers Union and a former member of the USDA's Advisory Committee on Agricultural Biotechnology. By not considering AMPA residues when setting the legally allowed levels of glyphosate residue, Hansen said the maximum residue limit, MRL, or tolerance, as the EPA calls it, is functionally made much higher. To put it more simply, by ignoring the residues of the byproduct of glyphosate, more glyphosate residues are legally allowed to be considered safe. Since at least the 1960s, world food and health experts have sought to gauge how much of a pesticide can be ingested on a daily basis, an acceptable daily intake, ADI, over a lifetime, without any noteworthy health risk. U.S. regulators typically use the term chronic reference dose, but the idea is essentially the same. To establish a limit on how much of a pesticide a given individual can ingest or be exposed to in a day without exceeding levels that regulators believe could be of concern. Chronic reference doses are typically based on what animal studies show to be the lowest dose at which adverse health effects caused by a pesticide are seen. The EPA takes the human equivalent amount of pesticide that harms animals and lowers it significantly in a formula designed to provide protection to human health. That acceptable dose is set at 1.7 milligrams, mg, of glyphosate per kilogram, kg, of a person's body weight per day for Americans. The European Union, in contrast, says the acceptable intake is more than five-fold lower, or 0.3 milligrams per kilogram per day. Separately, many countries also set different tolerance levels for the amount of pesticide residue legally allowed in foods. These MRLs vary for different types of grains and food, and they correlate to the maximum amount of residue that is expected following proper application of whatever pesticide the tolerance is tied to. Tolerances for pesticides may differ depending on the commodity. For example, although the tolerance for the insecticide chlorpyrifos is 1 part per million ppm on cherries, it is 2 ppm on radishes. The EPA uses the tolerance levels together with estimated concentrations in drinking water to calculate people's high-end dietary exposure to a pesticide based on a typical diet, making sure that estimated exposures do not exceed the ADI or reference dose. The United States allows among the highest levels of glyphosate residues, which critics say underscores the level of influence Monsanto has with regulators. They point to 2013, when Monsanto asked for and received EPA approval to allow even higher tolerance levels than were already allowed on many foods. Thousands of public comments opposing the move were filed with the agency, but the EPA backed Monsanto's position and responded to critics by insisting that glyphosate's safety was proven, exposures through food and water were low, and worries about ties to diseases such as cancer were unfounded. EPA has concluded that glyphosate does not pose a cancer risk to humans. Therefore, a dietary exposure assessment for the purpose of assessing cancer risk is unnecessary, the agency stated in a public notice. Tolerance levels for glyphosate have expanded significantly over the years in several crops. Data compiled by agricultural economist and researcher Charles Benbrook shows that tolerance levels for wheat, soybeans, and barley have all been raised to levels much higher than they were 20 years ago. The data make it clear that the more pesticide use the chemical companies promote, the higher the tolerance levels are set by the EPA. The EPA even has gone so far as to say that safety margins called for by law to protect children from pesticide exposures could be reduced when it comes to glyphosate. The Food Quality Protection Act calls for the EPA to use an extra tenfold, 10 times, safety factor when assessing exposure risk and establishing allowable levels for pesticide residues in food. Unless the EPA determines the extra margin is not necessary to protect infants and young children because the substance in question is so safe. That's exactly what the regulatory agency decided with glyphosate, saying it had adequate data to show that the extra margin of safety for glyphosate could be eliminated. There is a reasonable certainty that no harm will result to the general population or to infants and children from aggregate exposure to glyphosate residues. The agency stated in its 2013 decision to raise the allowable limits of glyphosate residues in some foods. Even with the EPA's generous allowances for glyphosate residues, many of the various individuals and organizations doing their own testing have found levels that exceed the tolerances, though many tests do show residues falling within the allowed thresholds. Still, critics say even residues that the EPA says are at safe levels may, in fact, be harmful to human health when consumed meal after meal, day after day. They believe that the EPA's analysis is outdated and not sufficient to protect people from the pervasiveness of many pesticides, such as glyphosate, that are often combined in food. Data from animal experiments suggest that when glyphosate is consumed, 15% to 30% of it is absorbed into the body. Some research has also shown it can cross the placenta during pregnancy. But there are far more questions than answers when it comes to glyphosate in food, according to businessman Henry Rowlands, who launched the Detox Project in California to test food and bodily fluids for glyphosate residues. Rowlands, who is from Wales, spends most of his time in Bulgaria, where he owns a language translation business. But his family heritage is rooted in farming, and as he watched the global debate over glyphosate unfold, he jumped in with both feet, getting to know researchers, working with activists, and putting his own money behind efforts to raise awareness. Rowlands said he found quickly that glyphosate is such a hot-button issue that even trying to find independent laboratories to run tests is a challenge. All but two of the American labs he sought out to help launch large-scale testing declined. More than 350 turned him down before Rowlands was able to forge an arrangement with the FDA-registered Enresco Laboratories in San Francisco to offer glyphosate residue testing to both nonprofits and commercial companies. "I'm certain it was political," Rowlands told me in a call from Bulgaria. "All of these labs test for big food producers. They aren't going to risk their bottom line looking for something food companies don't want people to find. It's really sad. They're not protecting public health." In some of the early work Rowlands had done by Enresco, the lab found glyphosate residues in a range of popular processed foods, including popular brands of cold cereal, crackers, and cookies. The private and non-profit attempts to test foods for glyphosate residues were well underway when the World Health Organization's cancer experts made their March 2015 decision to classify glyphosate as a probable human carcinogen. But testing efforts doubled after that, in large part because WHO's decision didn't stand alone. Rather, it added to warnings that many scientists had been making for years. The fallout was fast and furious as various government bodies and consumer groups rushed to respond. California's Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, OEHHA, went so far as to issue a public notice in September 2016 that it would list glyphosate as a cause of cancer under requirements of the state's Safe Drinking Water and Toxic Enforcement Act of 1986. In Germany, consumer protection officials called for a ban on glyphosate, and Colombia halted a program encouraged by the United States that sprayed glyphosate on illegal coca fields. Consumer organizations in the United States and Europe demanded that regulators take steps to restrict or ban glyphosate herbicides to protect both human health and the environment, and a petition signed by thousands of Americans was presented to the EPA in April 2016, demanding that glyphosate be revoked in the United States. Members of a nonprofit called Moms Across America armed with data about glyphosate residues, boarded a bus and launched a national toxin-free town tour to advocate for a rollback of glyphosate and other chemicals seen as harmful. "The fact is that cities simply cannot afford the risk of using Roundup any longer," said Zen Honeycutt, the group's director. Honeycutt, the mother of three boys, founded Moms Across America after she became convinced that pesticide-laden food contributed to the life-threatening food allergies that plagued one of her young sons. Her group's motto is Empowered Moms, Healthy Kids. Glyphosate is one of the group's most feared foes. Moms Across America and two other nonprofit groups didn't stop with petitions and marches. They sued General Mills in August 2016, accusing the company of deceptive advertising because some of the company's granola products, marketed as made with 100% natural whole grain oats, were allegedly found to contain glyphosate residues. Monsanto has done its best to quell the uproar and to assure consumers and regulators that the pesticide is safe. Monsanto officials have stressed repeatedly that they believe even if glyphosate residues are present in food or beverages, they can't be at levels high enough to be dangerous. So just how is the public to know if glyphosate residues are common in the food they buy for their families? And if the weed killer is in your food, how high are the levels? If the residues are there, are they at least within the levels set by the EPA as safe? Those should not be hard questions to answer. Indeed, because of the undeniable presence of pervasiveness of pesticides, it has long been the responsibility of the U.S. government to track pesticide levels in food and, importantly, to determine whether residues, if present, are below danger levels. Both the USDA and the FDA have spent decades regularly surveying samples of the American food supply to look at levels of pesticide residues. The testing is critical to protecting public health because a range of health problems are tied to pesticides. Some types, such as popular insecticides, are known to affect the nervous system. Others, like glyphosate, are suspected carcinogens, and others have the potential to cause harmful changes in human hormones. According to the EPA's website, the specific health effects of a particular pesticide depend on the pesticide's toxicity and how much of it is consumed. The EPA also notes that infants and children may be especially sensitive to health risks posed by pesticides. With all that in mind, and considering that glyphosate has been the most widely used herbicide on the planet, and that it has been the top agrochemical in the United States over several years, and that it is commonly used in food production, and that it is sprayed directly onto many types of food crops, one might expect it would be the priority in these residue sampling programs. After all, regulators routinely have looked for residues of other chemicals used far less in food production. And yet, the truth is this. U.S. regulators have spent decades not testing for glyphosate residues. Glyphosate stands out as the one key pesticide that regulators do not look for. Consider the Pesticide Data Program, PDP, that the USDA has conducted since 1991. Each year, the agency collects residue data for hundreds of pesticides in a range of food products. The analysis has even concluded infant formula and other baby foods as well as drinking water. The purpose of the program is to assure consumers that the food they feed their families is safe, according to the USDA. In its 2014 PDP annual summary, for instance, the USDA reported testing for residues of more than 400 different herbicides, insecticides, and other pesticides on food products. But how many tests did they run looking for glyphosate residues? None. Only one time in 2011 did the USDA search for glyphosate residues. It conducted what is called a special project in which it tested 300 soybean samples taken from 20 U.S. states for glyphosate. More than 90%, 271 of the samples, carried the weed killer residues. Almost all, 287, carried AMPA residues. The USDA said in addition to glyphosate and AMPA, 11 different pesticides were found in the soybeans, but less than 21% of the samples contained those other pesticide residues. Glyphosate was by far the most pervasive in the beans. Some thought the results might trigger more testing, but the agency said further testing for glyphosate was not a high priority because the chemical was considered so safe. It also said that while residue levels in some samples came close to the glyphosate tolerance allowed by the EPA, they did not exceed those levels. The USDA did come close to launching a very limited testing program in the spring of 2017, just as glyphosate concerns were reaching a fever pitch. Documents I obtained from within the agency show a plan to test over 300 samples of corn syrup for glyphosate starting in April 2017. But the agency quietly dropped the plan with little explanation just a couple of months before it was to begin. One of the USDA's excuses for not testing for glyphosate has been cost. The agency has said repeatedly over the years that it is too expensive and inefficient to look for glyphosate residues in food headed for American dinner tables. And, the agency says, because glyphosate is considered so safe, testing would be a waste of time. That argument mimics Monsanto's own. The company says if the USDA did seek to test glyphosate residues in food, it would be a misuse of valuable resources. Yet, while U.S. regulators don't test for glyphosate residues in the foods Americans eat, a division within the USDA known as the Grain Inspection, Packers and Stockyards Administration, GIPSA, does test for the residues in crops headed for food production overseas. GIPSA has been quietly testing wheat for glyphosate residues for years because many foreign buyers don't want glyphosate in this important food crop. GIPSA's testing is part of an export cargo sampling program. Documents I obtained from within GIPSA show. GIPSA's tests found glyphosate residues in more than 40% of hundreds of wheat samples examined in 2009, 2010, 2011, and 2012. According to documents I obtained through a Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, request. The levels vary, the data show, ranging up to 10 parts per million, ppm, well above the 4 ppm that Monsanto at one point had told the EPA should be tolerated and considered safe. GIPSA's testing results were not made available to the public in the USDA's annual programs reports, however. GIPSA's job is not to report these findings to the public, but rather to work with grain handlers, test manufacturers, and life science organizations to help in the marketing of U.S. grain. The FDA, like the USDA, has spent decades skipping any testing for glyphosate residues, despite the fact that looking for pesticide residues in food is also part of the agency's mandate for public protection. Since 1961, the agency has been conducting what it calls the Total Diet Study, TDS, to monitor levels of about 800 contaminants and nutrients in the average U.S. diet. The agency says that to conduct the study, it buys, prepares, and analyzes about 280 kinds of foods and beverages from representative areas of the country four times a year. The program began as a way to monitor for radioactive contamination of foods, but over time it expanded to include pesticides, industrial and other toxic chemicals, and nutrients. The FDA also conducts a residue monitoring program that measures pesticide levels in thousands of samples of fruits and vegetables, as well as other commodities. The ongoing nature of the study enables us to track trends in the average American diet and inform the development of interventions to reduce or minimize risks when needed, the FDA states on its website. But while it has spent years analyzing levels of other types of pesticide residues on food, the FDA, like the USDA, has steadfastly avoided testing for glyphosate residues in the American food supply. Never once, even as glyphosate use on food crops was skyrocketing in the 1980s and 1990s, not even one time did the FDA look for glyphosate, despite knowing that glyphosate residues were bound to show up in food. Tim Begley, a high-ranking official in the FDA's Center for Food Safety and Applied Nutrition, wrote to Michael Kashtok, another top official in the FDA's Food Safety Office, in January 2013, about illegal uses of glyphosate in Canada, Mexico, Thailand, and Brazil on some grains, soybeans, citrus, tropical fruits, including mangoes. The European Union found a hit rate of about 10% in cereals, Begley wrote. The agency should start developing a method so that at some point it could test for glyphosate, he said. Still, it was only in February 2016, nearly a year after WHO's classification of glyphosate as a probable human carcinogen, and with public pressure mounting for government accountability, that FDA officials said they would do some limited testing for glyphosate residues on a handful of foods that included corn, milk, and eggs. And that was nearly 2 years after the U.S. Government Accountability Office, GAO, sharply rebuked the agency for its failure to look for glyphosate. In its 2014 report, the GAO also hammered the FDA for not telling the public that it was skipping over glyphosate testing. And, in a worrisome note, the GAO also made clear that even if the FDA had been testing, there was no surety the results would be reliable because the agency's practices were deeply flawed. According to the criticism leveled by the GAO, there were significant limitations to the credibility of the FDA data on chemical residues that the agency did look for. FDA's ability to reliably identify specific commodities that may be at high risk of violating pesticide residue tolerances is limited, the report stated. In its defense, the FDA cited the costliness of testing for glyphosate, just as the USDA had done. The startup costs for glyphosate testing at six FDA testing laboratories would be around $5 million, according to a statement the FDA gave the GAO. Considering the stakes, not to mention the fact that the FDA's federal budget is around $5 billion, the excuses and inaction frustrate many moms, such as Laura Bowman of Scottsdale, Arizona. Bowman is not a member of any of the burgeoning food movement organizations that have sprung up in recent years, but she does consider herself fairly well-educated on the dangers of pesticides and other chemicals, and she does her best to protect her family from them. She banned the use of Roundup to control weeds in her yard long before the recent controversies flared, but she feels it's nearly impossible to keep glyphosate out of her family's meals. I feel like it's in almost everything we consume and our kids consume, and the frustrating part is our government does nothing about it, said Bowman, who tries to serve organically grown foods to her husband and two daughters whenever possible, in an effort to minimize consumption of pesticide residues. You try to do the small amount you can do, but so much of it is out of our control. Canadian authorities also ignored glyphosate and annual residue testing for years. But after WHO's glyphosate classification, they jumped into action. And in early 2017, the Canadian Food Inspection Agency, CFIA, announced the results. With a little more than 3,100 foods tested for glyphosate, residues of the weed killer were found in roughly 30% of the samples. The CFIA assured consumers there was nothing to worry about because only 1.3% of the samples showed residues above the tolerance levels. Still, the results were upsetting to many. Roughly 4% of the grain products tested had such high levels of glyphosate that they violated legal limits, the CFIA report showed. It's not just glyphosate residues that people worry about, of course. Fears about a range of chemical residues in food have been growing in recent years. Pesticide residues can be found in everything from mushrooms to potatoes and grapes to green beans. One sample of strawberries examined by the USDA in an annual testing program found residues of 20 pesticides in the berries. In fact, roughly 85% of more than 10,000 food samples tested by the USDA in 2015 carried pesticide residues. Most of those foods were fruits and vegetables, both fresh and processed, foods consumers generally consider healthy. Residue levels higher than what the government allows have been found in spinach, strawberries, grapes, green beans, tomatoes, cucumbers, and watermelon. Even residues of chemicals long banned in the United States were found as recently as 2015, including residues of DDT or its metabolites found in spinach and potatoes. U.S. regulators have also reported finding illegally high levels of the neonicotinoid insecticide, thiamethoxam, in rice. The USDA asserts that all these pesticide residues are nothing for people to worry about. The agency states that residues found in agricultural products sampled are at levels that do not pose risk to consumers' health and are safe. But many scientists say there is little to no data to back up that claim. The animal studies the regulators rely on to set the allowable pesticide levels are typically conducted by, or on behalf of, the pesticide companies and look only at the effects of one pesticide at a time. Regulators do not have sufficient research regarding how consuming residues of multiple types of pesticides affects us over the long term, and government assurances of safety are simply false, say the skeptical scientists. We don't know if you eat an apple that has multiple residues every day, what will be the consequences 20 years down the road, said Chensheng Liu, Associate Professor of Environmental Exposure Biology at the Harvard T.H. Chan School of Public Health. They want to assure everybody that this is safe, but the science is quite inadequate. This is a big issue. When it comes to pesticide exposures, through food or otherwise, researchers are particularly worried about children. Multiple studies suggest pesticides are harming children's brains and bodies. Researchers found that women's exposure to pesticides during pregnancy, measured through urine and blood samples, was associated with negative impacts on their children's IQ and neurobehavioral development, as well as with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder diagnoses. Also, one study that looked at structural brain growth using magnetic resonance imaging found significant abnormalities in measurements of the brain and determined that children whose mothers were exposed to organophosphate pesticides showed neurotoxic effects well into the early school years, at least. A team of international scientists examining the effects of pesticides in food and on farms summed up the problem this way. Recent insight into the toxic effects of pesticide exposure suggests that early life exposure is of greatest concern, especially prenatal exposure that may harm brain development. No systematic testing is available since testing for neurotoxicity, especially developmental neurotoxicity, has not consistently been required as part of the regulatory registration process. At least 100 different pesticides are known to cause adverse neurological effects in adults, and all of these substances must therefore be suspected of being capable of damaging developing brains as well. Philippe Grandjean, a co-author of that report and a Harvard adjunct professor of environmental health, who received his medical degree in Denmark at the age of 23, believes the warning signs must be taken seriously. He urges women who are pregnant, who plan to become pregnant, or who are breastfeeding, to seek out organically grown foods because their pesticide levels are far less than those found in conventionally grown foods. Grandjean is an expert in this area, traveling the world to study environmental problems and to examine children whose lives have been affected by environmental chemicals. He received the John F. Goldsmith Award from the International Society for Environmental Epidemiology in 2016 for sustained and outstanding contributions to the knowledge and practice of environmental epidemiology. Overall, consumption of organic food substantially decreases the consumer's dietary pesticide exposure, as well as acute and chronic risks from such exposure, the scientists' report stated. Pesticides undergo a comprehensive risk assessment before market release, but important gaps remain. Grandjean has little faith in regulatory assurances that current limits on pesticide amounts in certain foods are safe. Those limits are based on animal studies, looking at the effect of one pesticide at a time, he said. The human brain is so much more complex than the rat brain, and our brain development is much more vulnerable. Though pesticide residues are invisible, odorless, and tasteless, more consumers are becoming aware of, and unsettled by, their presence. Every year for the past decade, the International Food Information Council, IFIC, has surveyed more than 1,000 Americans to gain insight into their attitudes toward food and diet. The group, which quizzes people ranging in age from 18 to 80, says the results show a clear and steady rise in the number of Americans concerned about chemicals in their food. More than one-third of consumers participating in an annual food industry survey in 2015 and 2016 rated chemicals in food as their most important food safety issue, and many report changing their eating habits because of their worries. But glyphosate stands out as among the most feared, largely because it is so pervasive, because there are ongoing questions about its safety, and because of the government's reluctance to monitor foods for glyphosate residues. With all that in mind, the recognition that this weed-killing pesticide is in our food is more than many can stand. San Francisco resident Danielle Cooper filed a lawsuit in April 2016, seeking class action status against the Quaker Oats Company after glyphosate residues were found in that company's oat products, which are used by millions of consumers as cereal and for baking cookies and other treats. Cooper said she expected the oat products labeled 100% natural to be pesticide-free. Glyphosate is a dangerous substance, the presence and dangers of which should be disclosed, the lawsuit stated. Quaker, owned by PepsiCo, responded to the lawsuit by saying that glyphosate residues, if present, were so low as to not be a problem. Worries about weed killer residues have also disrupted international trade. In May 2016, Taiwan authorities and U.S. food safety inspectors found glyphosate residues in oatmeal products imported by Taiwan, prompting a recall of nearly 62,000 kilograms of oatmeal. The concerns in the marketplace finally prompted one of the FDA's most talented chemists, Nerong Chemkasem, to run his own in-house tests on glyphosate in oats. Chemkasem had obtained a doctorate in analytical chemistry and worked for the giant Swiss agrochemical company Syngenta AG for 15 years before joining the FDA in 2008, and he was quite familiar with the ins and outs of testing for agrochemicals. At that time, FDA scientists were working to bring the agency into the modern era of pesticide residue testing, implementing methods that were already in place in Australia, Canada, China, Denmark, Germany, Japan, the Netherlands, and the United Kingdom. Because the FDA had not looked for glyphosate residues in food for decades, the tests Chemkasem ran on oats were among the first. The results were not reassuring for anyone worried about feeding themselves or their children. Just as did the private researchers, Chemkasem found glyphosate residues in numerous oatmeal products, including infant oat cereal. He presented his findings to a group of chemists in a meeting in Florida in July 2016, but the FDA did not publicize the findings at all. Oats are not genetically engineered to tolerate glyphosate, but Monsanto has encouraged farmers to spray oats and other non-genetically modified crops with its glyphosate-based Roundup herbicides shortly before harvest to help dry down and even out the maturity of the crop. The company even provides farmers with a booklet telling them, "A pre-harvest weed control application is an excellent management strategy to not only control perennial weeds, but to facilitate harvest management and get a head start on next year's crop." In Canada, which is among the world's largest oat producers and is a major supplier of oats to the United States, Monsanto marketing materials tout the benefits of glyphosate on oat fields. Pre-harvest application of Roundup WeatherMax and Roundup Transorb HC are registered for application on all oat varieties, including milling oats destined for human consumption. Glyphosate is also used by U.S. oat farmers. The EPA estimates that about 100,000 pounds of glyphosate is used annually in production of oats in the United States. Considering the growing public angst over pesticide residues in our food, one might have expected FDA officials to shout it from the rooftops when the agency decided to start a formal glyphosate residue testing project in 2016. That was not the case. The agency made it clear that until the results were in, the less that was publicly known about what it was doing, the better. I got wind of the FDA's decision to do at least one glyphosate residue testing project through a couple of government sources who couldn't talk to me about it openly because they said the issue was so sensitive. It took weeks of badgering before the FDA would even acknowledge to me that it planned to do some tests for glyphosate. I wrote a news story about that move that got picked up and repeated around the world. But FDA officials repeatedly refused to answer many important questions about the methodology and whether or not Monsanto had any influence in the testing project. The agency also balked at producing documents about its glyphosate residue testing work. Among the documents it did produce as a result of my FOIA requests, many contained heavy redactions, meaning many sections were blacked out. What was revealed in these pages, however, was concerning enough. Take honey, for instance. Again, it was Chamkasem doing the work. According to those FDA documents, when Chamkasem examined honey samples from various locations in the United States, he came up with alarming results. He found that all of the honey examined, including organic honey, contained glyphosate residues. Some of the honey even showed residue levels more than 5 times the legally allowed limit in the European Union, according to these internal documents and research data. One brand that contained the residues was Iowa-based Sioux Bee Honey, which is marketed by a cooperative of American beekeepers as pure, all-natural, and America's honey. One sample of honey from Iowa showed glyphosate residues at 650 parts per billion, ppb, well over the 50 ppb allowed in the European Union. Now, honey comes from bees, of course, and beekeepers do not use glyphosate on their hives. There is no need, as weeds are not an issue in beekeeping. But bees travel many miles, and when they are near farm fields, they spend their days darting from plant to plant, including an array of crops such as cotton, alfalfa, soybeans, and many others grown in fields that are sprayed with glyphosate. The pesticide travels back with the bees to the hives, where the honey is produced. Darren Cox, past president of the American Honey Producers Association, describes bees as flying dust mops, picking up everything they touch. With that in mind, it's easy to see how glyphosate levels might be high in honey from Iowa, given that Iowa is the nation's top corn-growing state, and most of the corn is genetically modified to be sprayed directly with glyphosate. When Chamkasem found such high levels in honey, he wrote to colleagues in January 2016 email exchanges, notifying them of his findings and pointing out that at that time there was no legal tolerance level for glyphosate in honey in the United States, so any amount of detectable glyphosate in honey would be illegal. True, noted Chris Sack, an FDA chemist who oversees the agency's pesticide residue testing and is considered the agency's residue expert. But Sack tried to defuse Chamkasem's concerns. Before you pursue the regulatory status of honey, you need to know that the agency is undecided about how to address violations of glyphosate in honey, Sachs said in the email exchange. EPA has been made aware of this problem and was expected to set tolerance levels for honey, Sachs wrote. Once tolerance levels are set by the EPA, if they are set high enough, the residues are no longer considered illegal. Still, the business owners who keep the bees and sell honey are worried. They say it is frustrating to know they can't keep their product free of a pesticide that they have no use for and don't benefit from in any way. Many fear that if public awareness of pesticide levels grows, imported honey from countries that are not so reliant on pesticides will knock them out of the marketplace. I'm an innocent man with thousands of beehives. I can't do anything about the farmers using Roundup and the bees picking it up off cotton or something, said Nate Carmichael, a young husband and father who, along with his wife, Marcella, tends to about 10,000 hives and makes a living selling honey to grocery stores and outlets such as Walmart. The company packs around 1 million pounds of honey to sell in a good season. I don't understand how I'm supposed to control the level of glyphosate in my honey when I'm not the one using Roundup. It's all around me, Carmichael said. Marcella is a registered nurse who works with oncology patients, and she has long feared the adverse effects that pesticide residues could have on her family's health. She tries to buy organically grown food and feeds her young daughter the healthiest meals she can, so she was shocked and saddened to learn of the weed killer found in her company's honey. What can you do? I'm sure you'll find pesticides in almost everything. It makes you feel so helpless, she said. How do we protect our children? Knowing that glyphosate is in honey also upsets Margaret Lombard, chief executive officer of the National Honey Board, which promotes honey products to consumers. She sees the situation as not only an injustice to beekeepers, but also an indicator of how hard it is to escape contamination of the larger food supply. It seems like everything we're eating has this chemical in it, she said. The FDA's decision to start testing for glyphosate residues attracted Monsanto's attention, as would be expected. As testing was ramping up in the spring of 2016, Monsanto's International Regulatory Affairs Manager, Amelia Jackson-Gaisari, asked Lauren Robin, chief of the FDA's Plant Products Branch, to set up a time to talk about enforcement of residue levels in the USA, particularly glyphosate, according to the FDA records I obtained. The FDA said it does not have extended communications with Monsanto on this topic, and Monsanto does not influence the FDA's work. But it's noteworthy that even as the FDA engaged in conversation with Monsanto about residues, it did not inform the public about the glyphosate residues found in honey or in oats. It's clear the government has long been aware of glyphosate residues in food. In one intra-agency email exchange in 2015, FDA chemist Cham Kasem said, I believe we will see a lot of violation for glyphosate. Within a few months after Cham Kasem did his tests, the FDA abruptly halted his pesticide residue testing operations, deciding that additional work could and should be handled by other FDA chemists elsewhere. The FDA also suspended glyphosate residue testing for 9 months, resuming limited testing in June 2017. The fact that the FDA and the USDA have dragged their feet on testing for so long frustrates many who are concerned about the pesticide. There is no sense of urgency around these exposures that we live with day in and day out, said Jay Feldman, executive director of Beyond Pesticides, whose organization met with the EPA in January 2016 to argue for more government action on glyphosate. The reluctance of the U.S. government to examine food for glyphosate residues has also been noted across the Atlantic, in Europe, where glyphosate is a growing concern. Michael Antonio, a molecular geneticist in London, who has been among many researchers studying glyphosate and formulations such as Roundup, said, with increasing evidence from laboratory studies showing that glyphosate-based herbicides can result in a wide range of chronic illnesses through multiple mechanisms, it has become imperative to ascertain the levels of glyphosate in food and in as large a section of the human population as possible. Chapter 5. Under the Microscope. So just how dangerous is glyphosate? Most people would agree that, as with virtually any pesticide, it's not a good idea to drink it, bathe in it, or inhale it. Farm workers are trained to wear protective gear when applying or mixing their farm chemicals and to follow an assortment of guidelines to protect themselves and others from harmful exposures. But the question of exactly how dangerous long-term use of glyphosate might be, especially in formulations such as Roundup, has thus far been hard to answer. Monsanto Company and many leading chemical industry experts tell us that we should trust them and that more research is not needed. The safety of glyphosate and Roundup is proven, they say. But trust is hard to come by when the government does not require robust long-term safety data for a finished product such as Roundup, only for the active ingredient. There have long been concerns that the end product is more dangerous than glyphosate alone.